Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we're so thrilled to have Michael Weinberg and Joel McMull joining Emery Roan and me. We're going to talk about the amazingly enthralling world of 3D printing and scanning and all of the copyright issues related thereto. There are many. We have a chocolate-related trademark battle for you to chew on, as well as an update on the case against a maker of LARPing arrows. That has flamed out. We'll also consider Peter Thiel, Hulk Hogan, and Gawker. Gawker has just declared bankruptcy as of our beginning of the show today. All this and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 349, recorded June 10th, 2016. Fire on all the things. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by TunnelBear. TunnelBear is the simple privacy app that makes it easy to encrypt your internet connection and browse privately. Learn more and get your free TunnelBear at trytunnelbear.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you are joining us for This Week in Law. I am so excited about our panel this week, and you're going to be too once I introduce you to them. Returning to the show after too long a break and a big job change is Michael Weinberg. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back, Michael, in case you're not as closely following along with the careers of our guests and their background and what they're up to.
How could you not be?
As I am. I know it. How could you not be? Michael is formerly of Public Knowledge, where he did a ton of great advocacy work, writing. And as people have been asking me about the show this week and asking me who the guests are, I'm calling you, Michael, the world's foremost authority in 3D printing law. So I'm just going to call you that.
3D printing law attendee.
I hope you're comfortable with that moniker because it's yours now. He is now counsel at Shapeways, general counsel at Shapeways. So great to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us this week is Joel McMull from the Archer and Grenier firm in New York. He's a colleague of Ron Coleman's, who we had on not too long ago. And together, he and Ron represent The Slants, who we've talked about a lot on the show, the band out of Portland that has a trademark slash First Amendment issue pending before the United States Supreme Court. He also practices IP and technology law. And it's just great to meet you, Joel, and have you on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me. Pleased to be here.
Also here with me is one of my two illustrious co-hosts. Emery Roan is with us this week. Hi, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Hey, listeners. Michael, Joel. I am, as always, super excited to be here. I think we have an awesome show today.
I'm with you. I can't wait. Let's get right into it and start in the area of copyright. So, Michael, with you on the show, I want to go deep, obviously, on these thorny issues concerning 3D printing, 3D scanning, and copyright. Why don't we start with 3D scanning, which is something that people might be less familiar with than 3D printing? And because people might be less familiar with it, can you just start from a very high level and tell us what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of like reverse 3D printing. But basically, what you do is you have a machine that if you have a physical object that you want to digitize, you take the machine and you scan the object, and it turns it into a digital file that represents the object. And so this has been a lot like 3D printing. There have been big industrial machines for decades. You can get machines that will scan a building down to the millimeter or the submillimeter accuracy, but we're now seeing them more and more accessible in for everyday use. And actually, yesterday when Lenovo announced their new phone, this new whatever Motorola Z or whatever it's called, with the Project Tango computer vision elements in it, that means that that's a 3D scanner in your pocket. And so we're now at the point where cell phones have 3D scanners, and so you can scan things and turn it into a file. and do all the things with digital file that you would imagine you could do?
Wow, let me kind of get my head around that. You can download an app to your phone that is a 3D scanning app.
Yeah, so you can download an app to your to any phone right now that's a 3D scanning app. It's called 123D Catch. And the way that that one works is basically you take a whole series of still pictures and it stitches it into a 3D model. So that's actually been around for a little while. The new thing that's going to that is now coming out is there's actually going to be kind of dedicated cameras and dedicated chips. And so the scans will be much better and much faster. So yeah, your phone, you can just like turn the world around you into a digital file.
Oh, that's so cool. And then the dedicated cameras are going to be, they're just going to give you a more robust, detailed kind of quality.
Yeah, it'll just be, it'll be sort of better on all the metrics. So it'll be more accurate. It'll be faster. It'll be much sharper picture or image. So yeah, it'll be just a better experience and easier to use. You won't need to, as many technical skills to kind of clean up the scan and change it from what you scanned to what you might want as the output file.
And just playing that out, I know I'm not on the legal issues here. I'm getting all bogged down and fascinated by the tech.
But, with the toys.
Yes, exactly. But it is one of the big purposes of having apps and small camera tools that aren't scanning buildings, but might be scanning, you know, the bottle on the table next to you or whatever you decide is a useful thing to have a 3D scan of. Is that all geared toward the virtual reality world, or why, you know, what blossom of creativity do you see coming out of all this?
Yeah, there are all sorts of applications, and it's early days, so we'll probably see more. But certainly if you wanted to bring a physical item into virtual reality, a 3D scan is an important first step. If you wanted to be able to 3D print a physical object, but you didn't have the file for it, you can create the file by scanning it. And then there's a lot of machine vision things that come out of being able to easily 3D scan and digitize a physical environment. Because if you have a digital map of a physical space or a physical object, you can do all sorts of analysis. And if it's that, if it's a kind of a dynamic, a 3D file as opposed to just a 2D image, that analysis can be that much better. So there's a whole sort of range of options that you can see, because you can, it just basically allows computers to understand a world with depth as opposed to just a 2D camera.
Wow. So one thing that it could be used for is I tend to think of 3D printer files, files that people are using to create things that they might put on a marketplace such as your company's, as something that was created without a scan. But many times it's created just by scanning the item itself, and then you have your file.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can think of there's two paths to having a digital file for an object, right? One is that you built it in a CAD environment, and one is that you scanned something you already had.
Great. That brings up the copyright questions.
Exactly. What a nice segue
smoothly into that.
Perfect. So conveniently enough, Michael and Shapeways have just done a white paper on 3D scanning and copyright, and lay out nicely for people who might be wondering, gee, what are my copyrights in something that I have 3D scanned, that they might not exist at all. Can you tell us more about that, Michael?
Yeah, and it's exciting to do this on a law show, because we can get a little bit more granular than I sometimes
do. Let's
go
all the way in the weeds. All right, up to my neck.
I'll start not in the weeds, but still in fun places. So you need to make a distinction between the file, the ownership of the file, and the ownership of the object. But the idea is, when you create a digital file from an object, do you own a copyright in that file? And in the United States, there's a very compelling argument, and there's case law on this, that basically says no. Creating a digital file, that work is not a work that's protected by copyright. Now, again, if you're scanning an object that's protected by copyright, you might be infringing on the object you're scanning, but you don't get your own copyright in the digital file. And if you're scanning something that's either in the public domain or not protected by copyright, then the act of scanning doesn't kind of add another layer of copyright protection on it. So scan files themselves don't get a copyright in the way that, say, photograph, you know, digital photograph files or regular photographs also are protected by copyright.
Okay. All right,
so obviously that is the densest, the real question. I mean, I'm not sure if the rest of our panel has dug into your white paper. I did over this week. But I mean, to summarize, it comes down to whether or not this scan is expressive or representational, right? Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, I think that's the easiest way for me. That's the way I think about it that makes it easy. And so the question is sort of, well, why aren't they protected by copyright? And the answer is that in most cases, they fail to meet the originality requirements of copyright because the purpose of the scan is to create a perfect digital copy or as close to a perfect digital copy as you can. And so that requires a lot of skill and a lot of work, but it expressly doesn't require you to inject creativity and originality into the file, because if you're injecting creativity, you're failing the purpose of making the scan in the first place. And so for most scans, for the scans that we were just talking about now of scanning a room or doing these things, these scans that are designed to represent the physical object in a digital space, there's no creativity, there's no originality, there's no copyright. There is, and you can, it's easy to, it's possible to imagine, and there are a couple real world examples of scans that are sort of intentionally inaccurate and intentionally, you know, quote unquote, bad. And those kind of scans, if you haven't, if you're making them intentionally inaccurate, you're probably injecting creative decision making. And so those scans probably would be protected by copyright, but it is likely that those will be the kind of vast minority of scans out there.
So I know that this is going to have a lot of effect in virtual reality. Earlier this week, Steam released an application called Destinations that lets people, it gives some tools and encourages people to build photogram or use photogrammetry to make scenes that people can then explore in virtual reality. So I guess my question is that when you look at stuff like that, where you're reproducing scenes, the line between what is just a representational scan and what is an expressive scan seems like it gets really, really fuzzy really quickly. Just for example, one of the only three scan scenes that are available to explore right now is a scene at an English churchyard, or wait, no, an English church, sorry. And you know, it's beautiful. The lighting comes through. They obviously shot it in the early morning. This fog is rising up. They obviously, in the comments, they talk about how they had to work fast to make sure that the lighting was accurate. But I could easily see the situation where you stage a scene and then record it so that that scene itself is the creative work. How does your distinction play out in situations like that?
Yeah, that's a really great question that I'm gonna like try to give an answer for that will be bad, but I think it's a great question, right? Because you think about what they're trying to do there. Are they trying to, when they're doing all the work, are they trying to capture that world as it is, or are they trying to enhance it to make it a dramatic space that maybe it isn't in real life? And that's maybe on the kind of digital prep side. But then even in the staging, right? I mean, might they argue that what they have done by staging the scene is really to create almost a sculpture where they've then digitized the sculpture? And so they say, yeah, we've got a copyright on the sculpture. We may not have an additional copyright on the scan file, but that preparation stage created something that was both original and fixed and therefore is protectable. So yeah, it's going to be really interesting as these disputes actually come up with, you know, with facts like that that give them a little bit of meat on the bones, and see how courts wrestle with the tension, what I hope they maintain is a tension, between the idea that simply scanning something to digitize it doesn't mean that it's protected by copyright, but being cognizant of the fact that that doesn't mean that there are no elements that could be protected by copyright, or that copyright is just completely disconnected to the analysis.
So,
well,
what about when? Sorry, go ahead.
Let me jump in for a sec. It's going to be hard, right? Because in the photography realm, we have a bright line rule. You take a photograph, it is copyrighted, and it does not matter.
Sort of know about that, actually.
Okay, let's discuss that, because I think that if I took a picture of the hole someone kicked in my wall that I had to have fixed to show it to a contractor, you know, here's what you're going to have to do. It's not a creative work. It's just representational, right? I want to show him or her what's going on here. Or if I were to, as you say, compose a picture of the study of objects on my desk right now in front of me and take a picture just because I think it's an interesting composition or it captures that moment in time or whatever, you could say that that's more of a creative work. But I think they're both photographs and I think they're both copyrighted, aren't they?
So I think, and this is like the rule of thumb that you know, you learn in copyright, you know, first year of copyright law, and you kind of take with you is that, you know, photographs categorically protected kind of end of analysis. And I think that's right in like the vast majority of cases. But in doing this white paper, because the analogy is so obvious, I did a bunch of time, I spent a bunch of time looking deeper into copyright and photography and found a really actually fantastic paper by Professor Justin Hughes, who really, really dug into this. And I think that the rule of thumb that photography is always protected by copyright makes sense, especially has made sense historically when almost all photography requires some sort of framing and intentionality. But as more and more photographs are created for like purely documentational purposes, it probably will reveal the fact that there are limits to this idea that photographs are all protected by copyright. And even when you look at the case law now, even going all the way back to like, you know, the Oscar Wilde case, like the classic, you know, first photography copyright case, there's a recognition by judges in opinions that while the photograph in front of them is protected by copyright, they're doing an analysis and they're recognizing that there are photographs that are not protected by copyright. You know, they're not the photograph in question in the case, but that category of non-protectable photographs has always existed. It just hasn't been particularly relevant. But, you know, Professor Hughes starts talking about things like, if you have a security camera that's just on 24/7, have you made any originality questions? If you have a satellite and the entire purpose of the satellite is to spin around the world and to just capture, you know, every decision has been made about just capturing the world, not kind of interpreting it. You see more and more generation of photographs that don't necessarily involve any creativity.
Right. We're back to monkey selfies.
At the suggestion of Parker Higgins at EFF, there's actually a footnote in the paper that's just a monkey selfie, which my design team did not like, but they figured out how to do. And that's exactly right. Yeah, there we go.
Perfect.
Right. But yeah, it's exactly right. We're back to monkey selfies. Because
All roads lead to monkey selfies is going to be our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are watching or listening and are a legal or other professional who needs to get continuing legal or other professional credit in your field. We have some information for you about that. If you go to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. We've got the 50 states of the United States run down for you as to where you might download forms and stuff that could be helpful. So all roads lead to monkey selfies, as they should. All right. Joel, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I was just the last few minutes, I think, have sort of summarized where I was going, which was, you know, if like the monkey selfie, we find ourselves going back to the preparation that I understand the photographer utilized in the course of that composition. I'm wondering what the impact would be, if any, different on the digital scans. I'm not sensing there is any, and if I've been listening correctly, there isn't any, right? As a matter of law, certainly there isn't any, at least as the law now stands.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that your preparation is technically oriented to make sure that your lighting is right to capture the object as accurately as possible, there's not a lot of creative decision making there. Once your decision making is influenced by something beyond the kind of pure technical requirement of getting as digitally accurate scan as possible, you get into a situation where it's more complicated. And also when you get, I think this gets more complicated when you're not scanning an object, but you're scanning a scene. And, you know, the question earlier about the church captures that, and you could think about it even larger. You know, at some point, there's maybe some selection of what's going on, and it'll be interesting to see how scanners actually get used on a general scale and what kind of things people are capturing, because there aren't super straightforward answers.
Right. But I want to unpack something you said, though, which is interesting, which is you said that to the extent that we move beyond the mere effort to capture from a digital perspective as accurate a scan as possible, I could imagine that in the course of doing that, or at least wanting that, you know, having that be an objective, that that in and of itself, again, I'm talking about this in the abstract, but that in and of itself could capture be an attempt to capture an artistic expression. And therefore be amenable to copyright in a manner in which, at least what we've talked about to date, wouldn't be.
Well, I'm thinking just like with the example that you were giving earlier with Shapeways, if I am an artist who, for whatever reason, doesn't want to create her work on, you know, using CAD software, if I want to sell a, you know, 3D printable sculpture of whatever that I make, and I make a sculpture and then scan that sculpture into it, wouldn't that sculpture be, I mean...
Yes, absolutely. So this is where like breaking up the distinction between the object being scanned and the scan itself becomes really important. Because if you're scanning an object that is itself protected by copyright,
so is
then
the
it's like the scan is not necessarily, it may be a derivative work, but whether or not the scan gets an independent copyright, especially if you are the person who both created the object and created the scan, doesn't necessarily matter, because whether or not the file gets its own copyright, unauthorized reproduction of a digital file that represents a physical object that's protected by copyright would infringe the copyright on the object. That's a straightforward sentence.
Right. I just keep thinking
Don't
of
worry,
like a Mickey Mouse bobblehead.
Clauses with commas in my head.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so the Mickey Mouse bobblehead. Like the act of scanning Mickey Mouse bobblehead does not put the Mickey Mouse bobblehead in the public domain, right?
Right. Right. Or Mickey Mouse.
Right, or Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. This is all fascinating stuff. And what I'm gleaning from the discussion so far is that maybe in the context of 3D printing and 3D scanning law developing, which it will, it could alter as well our reading interpretation of photography law, because, or maybe just as more and more photos are used for less artistic things as time moves on, which seems to be a progression that's happening since everyone has a camera on them at all times in one way or another. So that maybe we'll have to rethink the way we think about imagery captured in a digital file, to the point where in both universes you think about certain works being copyrighted and certain works not. Is that sort of where you wound up in the course of doing the white paper?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you end up interrogating the question of copyrightability a lot more, and on both photographs and scans. And my instinct is that the scans and photographs people care about will probably break down differently, whereas, you know, the majority of photographs that people care about will be protected by copyright, whereas the majority of scans that people care about may not be. But even as I say that, I'm like qualifying it as we go, because if you probably think about the volume of photographs taken in a given year today, the vast majority of them are probably automated photos. They're taken through some prop for security reasons or for monitoring reasons, you know, to monitor quality assurance on a production line or something. And those are, there are probably millions more of those than the selfies that I care about on my phone. So it may be that even by volume in both cases, most of those are not protected by copyright. But when you think about it kind of surfacing for an individual on a day-to-day basis, the photographs you care about will be really important. But the, you know, the scan of the 3,000-year-old sculpture from a museum won't lock up that sculpture under copyright again just because it was scanned and digitized.
Right.
But you raise an interesting... correctly that if, for example, I went to the 2,000, 5,000-year-old archaeological site with my family, and I'm, you know, I just went to Italy over winter vacation and brought with me my phone and the incredible Google app, Google Cardboard Camera, which lets you do a really simple stereoscopic 360-degree panorama. And it's just, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump away from photogrammetry, you know, especially with like next year's Tango-enabled phones. My thought is that if we are if I am on like a family trip, I want to be recording the moments because of the sentiment that I have attached to it, or the memory that I have attached to it. That's not necessarily, I don't know, it feels like it straddles that line between a sort of what you would say is a representational scan of sort of just capturing the moment. But also there's, you know, I would hope that a certain amount of copyright extends to that, that you would, you know, maintain control over that picture. And then I guess that's also sort of a segue to the next question I have, which for the issues, for the areas where copyright doesn't apply, do you want to talk a little bit about the idea of like losing control without copyright, or how artists and creators can still have control, maybe even if copyright doesn't apply?
Yeah. So I think on the first point, you're right that it gets more complicated, again, as you move away from scanning individual objects and more about capturing a moment, capturing a space where there might be more of a kind of artistic selection of what's going on. And yeah, that line is complicated. And questions, again, going back to the original point you made about the church, of maybe your kind of composition and arrangement of the objects that end up being captured, that's the real thing that copyright hooks onto. But regardless, yeah, I mean, you move onto a space and you say, okay, well, whatever it is, there will be some files that are not protected by copyright. What does that mean? And it's so easy, and I fall into this trap all the time because I'm an IP person first. Like, I kind of think copyright or no copyright, and if no copyright, then like, everything, you can do whatever. And it's important to remember that, you know, if you pay somebody to come scan your house or your whatever, an object in your face, they're under no legal obligation, regardless if there's a copyright attached to that file, they don't have to give you that file. Right? Like, the ownership of the file is still can still be covered by contract very easily.
Right.
And there are problems if that file gets kind of out in the wild, and whether or not the scanner can sue a random person on the internet for accessing it. But there are plenty of ways. The absence of copyright does not mean that there's simply just no way to professionalize the idea of creating scans, or no way to control them, because there's still just the control of the file itself. And that gives you a huge amount of control for at least as long as you can maintain it.
Right.
So do you
this
see...
This is going to be such...
I'm sorry. We're there's nothing to suggest... And there's nothing to suggest that standard work for hire agreements wouldn't apply to this technology or anything right. else.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Right. And in fact, you have a whole post, an interesting post on the Shapeways blog, Michael, about designers for hire who get the files, and encouraging people to think about this as they are hiring someone to do 3D capturing or design for them, and to work things out contractually in advance, because if you don't, it can get complicated. Same thing applies to web design or anytime you're hiring a creative person. You want to have a good understanding with them about who owns the copyright in the end work, if it's a creative work, and how that copyright is licensed or controlled. The post kind of speaks for itself and does sort of push it back on people in the marketplace saying, hey, this is an issue for you, and just be aware of it and take care of it. Is there anything else that you would add to that?
No, and I think, you know, we as attorneys, we know this, right, is that our marketplace, our designer for hire system, it works great. People love it, but there are obviously sometimes disputes. And almost every time the dispute, if you take the question that is forcing the dispute and you went back in time to the beginning of the agreement, neither party had thought about what if this thing happens. And so, you know, the real takeaway of that post is the same takeaway that any contract attorney will give you, which is some of the value of a contract is it just forces that conversation to say, like, oh, well, yeah, when we're done with this, there's going to be a file left over. Who gets it? What does it mean to have it? Who gets to control what's going on? And if nothing else, as a forcing mechanism to have that conversation between a client and a designer to set expectations can really help, because it reduces the chance that there is a misalignment later on. And if there is a misalignment later on, you figured out how you were going to resolve it when you weren't super mad at each other, which is true for every contract.
I think this is going to be such an interesting area of the law as it unfolds, involving issues of what sort of technology was used, what, you know, how the shutter was pushed, who was behind the shutter, the animal or other living
entity.
Yeah,
wasn't it the shutter?
Right.
Right. Well, the crazy thing is, it's like you could be looking at Denise, you're talking about earlier with, you know, how you get these files. You could be looking at a digital file, and if it was made in CAD, it's protected by copyright. If it was made by a scan, it's not protected by copyright. How do you, as an end user, know?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have an answer to that?
No. I mean, it's a problem.
Right.
Further research is needed.
One way that
I'll be accepting grants for that, by the way.
Well, the properties of the file, assuming that the end user has access to those, that would indicate whether or not there's a copyright or not.
Yeah, I mean, presumably, you know, like when the Nefertiti bust came out, whatever it was, a couple of months ago, people could look at it. People who are experts could look at it pretty quickly and say, well, clearly it probably came from a scan and it came from this kind of scanner. But if you're just sort of bumming around the internet and you find some file and you're not an expert, it's possible that either by the resolution or by some sort of metadata you can tell, but it's also certainly possible that you could be wrong.
Right. And the interesting thing is that even when people try and clarify the copyrights associated with things in the 3D world. And again, this applies beyond the world of 3D, but there was a case of, or an incident about it earlier this year. Over on Thingiverse, where people were applying Creative Commons licenses to their works. By the way, does Shapeways let you do that too? Have an automated system for that?
Shapeways does not, primarily because although we love Creative Commons as a company and work with them, you don't come to Shapeways to kind of download a file. Mm-hmm. And so the licenses connected to the files aren't as kind of critically tied to what's going on as it is with Thingiverse, where like the whole idea is for you to go on and download the file, and then you have the file and you can do things with it.
Got it. Well, in any event, many of these files were uploaded under a Creative Commons license for either attribution or non-commercial use only, the various restrictions that people could put on. But of course, for anyone who doesn't bother to read the license or even really care if there was a license applied or not, I kind of got the impression that might have been the case in the thing that happened earlier this year. There was a store on eBay that was called, I think, Just 3D Prints or Just 3D Printing, something like that, and was wholesale appropriating a bunch of stuff that was on the Thingiverse site and making it available for sale, regardless of the fact that these things were under, not only were they under copyright, but even though they were more freely licensed than they would have been under regular copyright, they weren't licensed for that use. So Thingiverse got involved. Users got sad. One of the impacted ones made a sad face, 3D printed item to bring attention to the issue. When I looked it up this morning, that eBay user no longer had anything for sale. Do you know what ultimately happened with that, Michael?
Yeah, it kind of burnt itself out. It burnt bright and hot and quick. Mm-hmm. I think it was a combination of there was a progression, because the response from the eBay user started with, when you put something up on the internet, you relinquish all copyrights.
Can we time out and pause and just appreciate this response that this guy had? It's like a 3,500 word, had to be screen capped in 5 different images, and it is the most incoherent, insane copyright discussion I've ever heard in my life.
And we do this show every week, so that's saying a lot.
If anyone tries to tell you how copyright works, begins by talking about a discussion of trade secrets before meandering through and ending with the idea that CC licenses are not worth the toilet paper they're not printed on, which is like a sentence that he used, run away.
Yeah. Run.
But, sorry, Mike. I didn't mean to interrupt, but that was just...
Did Creative Commons become involved? Because they're usually pretty militant in ensuring that their licenses are adhered to. I can only imagine they had an interest in this dispute.
They didn't get directly involved. Thingiverse eventually got involved. It's like this crazy incident, and it happened kind of over a weekend. And you're right, it was like there was these epic strings back and forth. I was in a situation where my wife was out of town, and so I was like angrily blogging about it as well, because that's what happens when she's gone. And yeah, I mean, it's like everything about it is epic, because yeah, the original response was this long thing that made no sense, which then, you know, people, including myself, wrote epic responses to, because that's how the internet works. And over the course of the weekend, essentially, the eBay user slowly backed away from various positions, and the Thingiverse community geared up to send a bunch of takedown notices to eBay. And by the end of the weekend, for the combination of threats of takedown notices, actual takedown notices, bad PR, and a reassessment of legal positions, the whole enterprise sort of shut down. These were the people who were running this who were doing the shop. They were had like some connection. They were Wharton some Business School startup. Students or something. Like, yeah, it was all gross. The things here.
So many gross things about this.
but actually, the good thing about it was that, and we sort of just had this experience with the scanning situation, is there have been a bunch of kind of interesting, quote unquote, interesting legal questions around 3D printing and 3D scanning and CC, and they've mostly operated in the world of theoretical. And so when there was this actual concrete freakout, there were real facts on the ground that you could kind of run through the analysis that everyone had been chewing on in the theoretical. And so it was a good opportunity to get kind of real world facts for questions. There was something to come out of it. And I will say, although Creative Commons didn't get involved in this, Creative Commons is getting really involved in the question of, if you have a file, a 3D printable file that's released under an attribution license, and there's no attribution kind of integrated into the object itself, what does it mean to give attribution? So if you release a 3D printable bracelet under a Creative Commons attribution license and I print it out, do I need to hang a little tag off my wrist that has your name on it as well? Or like, how does that work? Creative Commons is really jumping into that question, because really? It's one of the challenges around the licenses.
Wow.
That feels really like reminiscent to Barbie. Wasn't there a case about whether or not the copyright or trademark had to be public, like printed on a Barbie doll? I'm sorry. Obviously, I should have just had this information beforehand. excuse me.
No worries.
You're excused.
Barbie brain fade, I think, will be our second MCLE passphrase for the show, if that's okay with everyone.
Right here. It's on me.
But that's fine. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating issue, and really the way that kind of thing just works out is what people do in the course of business, course of operation, right? I mean, I can see a court saying you have coming in and saying, in order to give attribution, you have to use the person's name or their web address or something that identifies them. What do you think, Michael?
Right. Otherwise, it's meaningless. I mean, it's great. It's this classic, you know, theory into practice. The you know, from Marx to Lenin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Often after this show, I go and find Creative Commons licensed photographs on Flickr, and find them using the search engine there that lets you find ones that are available for creative use with attribution. Commercial use with attribution. And I send them on to the studio, and we use them as artwork that goes along with the show. It'll be on the show page. I post them to Flickr. I use them as our Facebook and Google+ cover image for the week, giving attribution to the person who took the photograph. And that gets complicated sometimes, making the decision, okay, they don't give a name, they're just using their user handle, so I guess I have to use that. And also, I always link back to the photo, so if someone has a question about who the author of that was on Flickr, then they can find it. But it's not, you know, I'm a lawyer going through that analysis. How do I give proper attribution to this person?
That's a little bit of a different issue, because that issue is, well, what is the successful attribution in that case, or the best attribution? And of course, you're operating on, you know, the limited universe of information you have. I think that's very different than not than giving no expression in the finished work, which is sort of the bracelet example.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And well, I don't know. I mean, the photograph itself doesn't give attribution. It falls to me, the user of the licensed work, to make sure that in publishing the photograph and using the photograph, I add that. That's certainly not what was going on in any way, shape, or form on eBay. I was curious, Michael, if the DMCA ever came up. Nobody
it did. It did come up. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that was, you know, like I said, it kind of it flared over a weekend, but there was the first reaction by the Thingiverse community was, like you said, to kind of put up this sad face and move through the public shaming phase. But then users started to figure out that they in fact had the option to send a takedown notice to eBay. And I don't actually know, while people were talking about doing it, I don't know if there was enough time between when the kind of Thingiverse community realized that that was an option and the models were taken down for an actual model to be taken down, but it certainly would have been an option, right? And it's a step that you could have used to resolve the issue.
Yeah. All right, we could stay on this all day, but I don't think we will. Unfortunately, we've got lots of other interesting stuff to discuss too, including another case that Shapeways is involved in tangentially. They and we've talked about it several times on the show now. It's this case, the Star Athletica case, pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, and Shapeways has filed an amicus brief there because, and just as a refresher for those who might not remember what this case is about, it's about cheerleader uniforms, and it's about certain elements of the cheerleader uniforms that one company is claiming as their copyrighted creative works, and the opposing party is saying, no, you can't have a copyright in things like chevrons. They're design elements or the shape of a shirt. Those are not things, those are functional. They're not subject to copyright. And so go away. And the Shapeways is weighing in on this because this could have some impact in the 3D printing realm, right, Michael?
Yeah, and you know, not within a narrow question, the question of, you know, when a tennis skirt becomes a cheerleading uniform, but is the larger the larger issue is kind of, you know, when you learn IP law in this sort of theoretical world where you have one half of the universe is creative copyright objects and one half of the universe is functional patent objects and never the twain shall meet, you know, in the real world, many objects are a mixture of those two elements. And so the question, the meta question, the real question the Supreme Court is dealing with is, what test do you use to break out the creative and functional elements of an object to decide how much of it, if any of it, is protected by copyright? And right now, there are at least 10 different tests that are kind of connected and kind of not to how to answer that analysis. And so the brief that we did, which was the cert petition brief, was basically to the Supreme Court, this question has historically been, you know, moderately important and litigated. But as we see more and more 3D printable objects that are going to combine copyrightable and non-copyrightable elements, and rights holders probably try to assert control over all of them, you know, the entirety of the object, we need a single test to just understand who has what rights. And so Supreme Court, however you decide this cheerleader uniform case, whatever test you choose, just pick one so we all have the one test so we understand how to do the analysis.
Right. I wanted to, before we leave copyright, a couple more topics there. I wanted to just float by you all the judge's order in the Oracle versus Google case in support of the jury's determination of fair use. This was in response to Oracle's motion for judgment as a matter of law, which is a way to have the judge set aside the jury verdict if the judge is so inclined. Judge Alsup is not at all inclined to do that here and has a lengthy order supporting the fair use jury instructions and the analysis that the jury went through and how in the judge's estimation they arrived at the right result. Michael, I'm guessing that like the Star Athletica case where you know we need a straightforward test on the issue that you mentioned, that Shapeways 2 would be interested in seeing at least this part of this dispute hold up, that you could have a fair use exception to copyrightability of things that maybe shouldn't be under copyright anyway. I mean, if this case ever gets that issue before the Supreme Court, that issue may fall as well. So I just wondered if you were paying attention to this and thinking that this having this fair use determination stand is important.
Yeah, I will say that in my Shapeways capacity, I've been sort of keeping an eye on it, but we're not actively engaged in it. In my personal highly opinionated capacity, sure. Yeah, I mean, look, it's kind of dumb that these things that Google lost the first round, and so the question is it fair use to use these APIs as opposed to are they protected by copyright at all? But to the extent that they are protected by copyright, it is a good thing that a use of them is fair use. If that's the kind of workaround we are stuck with, it's better than the alternative, which is no workaround.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The finding of infringement.
Sorry, one at a time.
Sorry?
Joel first.
No, and I just added, and a finding of infringement.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right, and Emery, anything to add on the judge's order denying Oracle's motion for judgment as a matter of law?
Yeah, I mean, just a little bit. I mean, I had said before that, you know, my problem was that I wasn't sure how the API use, how the transformative analysis for use of APIs would play out, because it seemed to me that any kind of use of an API would probably be transformative based on the ruling. But the breakdown that the judge gave, I think, was pretty clear about why it was specifically in this case transformative. So the fact of the engineers, it's a good analysis. I'm happy with it.
Yes. All right. Moving on to one other copyright issue here. Again, not in your Shapeways capacity, Michael, but in your personal opinionated capacity. You have a piece on your personal site about the missing half of open source hardware licenses. We're, you know, without going too deep in the weeds on this, could you explain to us sort of where things stand on open source hardware licenses? People are probably more familiar with open source software licenses and what you're doing to sort of bring that world into a happy existence.
Yeah, the sort of the short version of it mm-hmm. is that the world of open source hardware is very much tied to open source software, but because hardware is not as fully encased in copyright as software is, that a lot of the norms that come out of the open source software world that rely on licensing to sort of control what's going on don't quite translate into the world of open source hardware. And mm-hmm. so the small issue that I was trying to flag in that post is about, you know, open source software licenses do at least two things. They tell a user that they are free to use without infringement if they follow the rules, and they allow a creator to kind of impose restrictions on future users. With hardware licenses, the hardware licenses can absolutely clear the decks for users and say, as a creator, to the extent that I have rights in this, you know, I will license them to you under these conditions. The problem with open source hardware licenses, because so much of the hardware is outside of the scope of copyright, if you think that you're imposing restrictions on downstream users that encompass your entire piece of hardware by using the license, you're probably going to be disappointed, because there are all sorts of uses of that hardware that, even if they violate the terms of the license, don't infringe any of your IP rights. And mm-hmm. so you're going to be in trouble. And so one of the kind of this shortcoming in open source hardware licenses is one of the reasons that the Open Source Hardware Association is developing an open hardware certification And what it basically is it's a certification mark that if you are saying this is open source hardware, you can, and you take the license and use the certification mark, there's at least a kind of commonly understood definition of open source hardware that everyone is on the same page with. And so while it is not a legal structure like a license, it is at least something that is backed up by, in this case, trademark law to bring a little bit of structure to the world of open source hardware. So that's like the 1 second version, or the whatever 5 minute version, but the short version.
Right. Can you give us an example of when hardware is copyrightable?
Yeah. So if you think of a piece of hardware that has non-functional expressive elements, so, you know, one of the most popular kinds of open source hardware are these little Arduino development boards. And people make these really cool ones that have like flames on them, and they're like black with red, and they look really neat. And, you know, the flame decals and the black and red have nothing to do with the functionality of the board. They're purely decorative. Right. And so those are easily protected by copyright. But, you know, the board, the layout, the actual board itself, the functionality of the board is beyond the scope of copyright. And so if you release a microcontroller board into the universe, or you release a drone into the world and you say, this drone is, you can't use this drone for commercial purposes, or you can't replicate this drone for commercial purposes. And if you do, I'll sue you for copyright infringement. You know, if I take the propellers and the struts from your drone and sell them commercially, you can't sue me for copyright infringement because the propellers and the struts on your drone aren't protected by copyright. And so there's sort of an expectations problem.
Is this something that could be... It feels like this is almost a Creative Commons issue, and we saw the Creative Commons licensing come up earlier when we were talking about the Thingiverse, you know, fiasco. Certainly there are people that are, I mean, when I was first reading this, my first thought was imagining, you know, 3D printed machines that sort of come out of the printer already assembled. If I license that under a Creative Commons license, you're saying that wouldn't work because it could just simply be deassembled and the individual parts could be sold?
Yeah, I mean, the point is that there are parts of the machine that are functional, and as a functional element, it's outside of the scope of copyright. And so if you think you're wrapping it in a copyright license, there's no copyright to use as a hook. But you're right that this is actually a latent, and maybe not so latent, issue in the world of 3D printable objects. You know, you go to a site like Thingiverse, and one of the great things about Thingiverse is that when you upload a model, it says pick a license for it. But the entire exercise assumes that the thing you're uploading is protected by copyright. And even in the eBay case that we were talking about earlier, you know, that company had slurped down 2,500 models from Thingiverse. And while the ones that were getting the high profile attention were clearly creative objects, it was like a dragon sculpture, totally protected by copyright. The Creative Commons license is highly relevant. It totally applies, no question. You know, if you have like if you upload a hook to Thingiverse that's just like a door hook that has no decorative elements and put a Creative Commons license on it, there's no copyright probably in that hook. And so if you think that you're putting it up there and saying no one can use this unless they give me attribution, and someone uses it without giving you attribution, you probably can't sue them for copyright infringement. And so there's one of the things that has happened, you know, in the last whatever 10 or 20 years of IP law is this sort of like huge awareness around copyright. But people haven't been trained that there are actually situations where you have to take a step back, and before you do your copyright analysis and your fair use analysis or your public domain analysis, you have to ask the question, is this thing even protected by copyright? Because if it's not, then none of the licenses in the world matter. I mean, you know, they're useful as a signaling device, but they're not legally enforceable. And as we get more and more physical objects that are distributed digitally, those parts of the objects or the objects themselves that exist beyond the reach of copyright, it becomes really important for people to understand that if it's beyond the reach of copyright, these licenses that you've been trained to hold completely sacrosanct actually are irrelevant. And copyright, which has felt to you as this right that extends forever in all directions for all things, really does have limits. And those limits are relevant both as a user, because if you see a restriction that's tied to copyright on a functional object, you can potentially ignore it. And as a creator, if you think that you're sharing your things with the world under certain conditions that are simply not enforceable.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I guess the moral of the story is to put flames on your hook.
There you go.
Flames on your hook.
Long story short, all hooks must have flames.
You know, I think from a trademark perspective, and I think of myself as having, you know, sounder trademark chops than I do copyright chops. Much of what Michael says would equally apply in trademark. That is, if you have an ornamental or functional object, you know, don't fool yourself by thinking that by pointing a trademark, you're going to find safety there either, because it is not, for the same reasons that Michael just articulated, you know, the panacea that certainly some creative artists believe that it might be, or at least marketing professionals, not creative artists, but marketing professionals.
Well, I could see. I mean, you bring up the Arduino boards. There are of course computer manufacturers. I have a kid who's a gamer, so there are lots of folks targeting his demographic, trying to make computers with cool lights and cooling elements and things that light up and, again, you know, have flames, basically. Right. But they are and keyboards that light up in certain ways. And again, I suppose we could have this same discussion about portions of that hardware being copyrightable and portions of it not.
Yeah, and also just to, cause, you know, to bring it, Joel, to bring it back to trademark. The trademark becomes really important in the context of open source hardware, regardless of the licensing questions, because if you have open source hardware and you've released all these files and these schematics, the one thing you can hold on to is your trademark. And so while anybody can make Arduino compatible boards, I mean, there's a huge trademark fight going on about this, but let's just assume this to be the case right now. only one company can make Arduino boards called Arduino. And that sourcing function of trademark for hardware is almost more important than software, because, you know, if you download open source software from some random website and run a checksum on it, it's fine. But when you're buying hardware, it really matters not just who designed it, but who actually physically put it together. And so when, you know, if you think of like open source hardware world being kind of a lower copyright environment, the trademark element can become unbelievably important, because it's the one thing that you have as a consumer to say, well, who actually built this thing?
Right. And of course, all of the quality attributions that come with that. Putting aside the genericness issue that you just identified, you know, that is, if Arduino boards are in fact called Arduino boards, they're in trouble. But I hear you and I agree with you.
So what is the answer, I guess, for people that want to distribute, maybe sell functional digital goods?
Yeah, I mean, the best answer I have right now is the value of this certification that the Open Source Hardware Association is doing. We've been doing some work with, some work on. There's some people kicking around. There are licenses out there, and I encourage people to look at them, because maybe my analysis is wrong. I know of at least one more license in the works. With open source hardware licenses, and I'm not a licensing expert, so I expect to be proven wrong about this at some point in the reasonably near future. But this sort of the fundamental problem around open source hardware licensing, where assuming if you're an open source hardware person, you're not going to get a bunch of patents just to openly license them, because that's irrational on a thousand different levels. You can't use your license to fully restrict downstream users. And in some ways, that's a win for openness. And that's part of the thing that open source software was originally kind of designed to fight against, was that software by default wasn't open. And so they had to kind of like hack around it. But hardware is kind of by default open. But if you've been, you know, there's 30 years of open source software cultural norms built into everyone. And so if the expectation is that I can restrict downstream users with a license, it's a public education problem in a lot of ways.
All right. Well, we're going to thank one of our sponsors and move on to more stories, including, we learned right before the show, I think that Gawker just told Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel to delete their account. So we're going to get to that in a moment. Before that, though, we do need to thank our sponsor, Tunnel Bear. You need to check out TunnelBear. It's the coolest thing. It's the simple VPN app that makes it easy to protect the privacy of your online activity and communications. As lawyers, of course, those of us here on the panel are constantly working to protect our clients. Unfortunately, we and others in our position don't always think about all the ways that we can unintentionally reveal sensitive information. Your home network and public Wi-Fi connections at the airport, the library, the courthouse, opposing counsel's office if you're there doing work, they all pose a great risk. Fortunately, it's incredibly easy to protect the data that you need to across all your devices. That's where TunnelBear comes in. It's an important privacy tool for anyone who connects to the internet, but it's even more important for professionals who regularly transmit sensitive or confidential information. You can start using a VPN like TunnelBear to increase the protection of your clients' confidential information, and you should. I mean, there's just no reason not to with the simplicity and ease of use of this tool. All you do is you choose a country in the app, you turn TunnelBear on, and you watch as your little bear, if you're watching, you can see the graphics, tunnels your internet connection to a new location. When TunnelBear is turned on, your internet connection is secured with the strongest possible encryption, and your online activity, including attorney-client privileged information, is shielded from prying third parties. TunnelBear has a top-rated privacy policy. Very importantly, it does not log your activity at all whatsoever. So what you're doing is confidential, and it's not going to be able to be discovered after the fact. Research sensitive cases online without leaving a trail back to your practice. TunnelBear is giving Twill listeners a chance to try their privacy and VPN app with 500 megabytes of free data every month and no credit card required. Just go to trytunnelbear.com/twill and try TunnelBear for free. It's the simple privacy app for your mobile and desktop browsing. I wanted to mention that it's available for iPhone and iPad. It's on Android. It's on Mac and Windows. And for your browser, it protects you on all those platforms. Thank you so much, TunnelBear, for your support of This Week in Law. You need to go to trytunnelbear.com/twill to get your free account today. It's easy, quick, and so worthwhile. So go check it out at trytunnelbear.com/twill. Thank you so much, TunnelBear. All right, so we're going to move on to the realm of journalism and the First Amendment and defamation.
Ooh. The bumper music is, yeah, very, I don't know, Colbert Report.
Yes, it is indeed. we learned just before the show that Gawker has actually filed for bankruptcy so as not to have to pay the huge judgment that it has incurred against Gawker in favor of Hulk Hogan in the case that it turns out was bankrolled by Peter Thiel. I think that's Gawker telling them to delete their account. Maybe this was the goal all along. If you listen to Thiel and him talking about why he bankrolled the case, is because he would like Gawker to delete its accounts. And when you file for bankruptcy, perhaps that's what you're doing. Joel, you noticed this and let us know that this had happened before the show. And as I told you, we haven't really gone into this case because it's a legal dispute in the technology industry. A captain of the technology industry has disclosed that he's involved. But on the financial side, it certainly impacts how online journalism is carried out or will be carried out in the wake of this case. So these are all good reasons for us to talk about it on the show, but we just haven't done so yet. So Joel, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. I don't even know where to start. There's so much to talk about with this case. Let me talk about today's developments, though, because I must confess, I have, you know, what I know about bankruptcy law, I could fit into a thimble. But from a procedural standpoint, does anyone on the panel understand what this means in the context of the appeal? So they're going to appeal the decision. They've now filed for bankruptcy. Should they succeed on the appeal, then what? They come out of bankruptcy? I don't understand how the filing for bankruptcy is consistent with their desire to appeal and presumably continue to conduct business. Those don't – I mean, there's automatically going to be a stay now, presumably, of the appeal pending the bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand – unless they're abandoning the appeal. Is that what this means? I mean, admittedly, I think I saw this maybe 10 minutes before we hopped on the call, so I don't really know how this is playing out. But I find myself procedurally confused as to what this all means. Anybody?
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around it.
We know technology. No.
Yeah.
You've mistaken me for a real lawyer, sir.
Ask me a copyright question.
All right. I actually have practiced and from time to time continue to practice appellate law, so I have to jump into this, I suppose. I don't know. Again, you kind of did stump me there. It seems to me like you should be able to proceed on both fronts. If bankruptcy is your only way out of paying the judgment, of course, there's no enforcement of the judgment until the appeal is over with. So it does seem a little premature. We just learned about this before the show and are going to have to look into that excellent procedural question a little bit more closely.
It is a super interesting question.
Yes.
I'm very curious who has the answer to it.
Right.
And it's probably really simple. It's just none of us know it. All right.
I think ordinarily you wouldn't file for bankruptcy unless you were facing imminent payment of the judgment. But again, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer either.
Right? Because, I mean, what are the costs that are going to be incurred? There's only the cost of the appeal. As you said, there's no final judgment yet to be enforced. So I don't get it. Mm-hmm. But that's probably because I'm missing something.
There's nothing that more says more drop the mic than filing bankruptcy, though, right?
That's definitely
grinds things to a halt.
No, absolutely it does. I mean, that's that is one of the things that's in the thimble. All proceedings are stayed.
Proceedings are stayed is in the thimble.
The next CLE that comes up, that's the tagline.
Right.
What I am, and again, to the extent that you haven't already exhausted this, what I do find very interesting, and again, I guess in my mind, the lead article on this is the Slate article that came out and talked about what's his name? Salmon, Felix Salmon, I think at the Slate wrote this Chicken Little, the Sky is Falling article a couple of weeks ago to talk about Peter Thiel's involvement in this and how this was the death of media. And as a result, this is a terrible, horrible thing. I'm that's my characterization and I'm giving it short shrift, but mm-hmm. It just doesn't resonate with me. It really doesn't. I mean, in an era in which I am counseling clients on issues of litigation financing, what Peter Thiel has done here, I think, is entirely consistent with the business model of litigation. The mm-hmm. fact that the subject of the litigation is the media makes absolutely no difference. I understand that there is a tradition amongst the First Amendment purists, of which, quite frankly, I like to think of myself as one, that the media resides in a special space. But I think that if we're now going to pick and choose, because this is implicit, I think, in the message, that not every litigation is amenable to third-party litigation financing, I think that's absurd. And I think it's, at a fundamental level, I think it's also inconsistent with the capitalist model. It's an investment, like any other investment, and Peter Thiel had an expectation of recovering on his investment. Now, that recovery may or may not be monetary in this case, but if even the objective was to bankrupt, and I'm not saying it was, but if it was to bankrupt Denton and his company, then that is his objective. And it's the fact that it may be perceived as a vendetta, I still think based on the facts and certainly the jury's determination inclined to agree with him that – it's a legitimate end. I'm sorry, I misspoke. The jury didn't agree with him to the extent that his objective was to bankrupt the company. I'm saying as a factual matter, they agreed, you know, with the arguments that Hulk Hogan's lawyers put forth.
Right. Anything you want to add to this from the privacy standpoint, Emery, since that's what is at the root of the case here? Is what Gawker did to Hogan and what other sites can do to other people?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really, really, really torn on here, obviously. I think it's a sticky issue that I know that I haven't really sorted out for myself yet. On the privacy angle, I mean, Hulk Hogan, I think, was a public figure. Like, I think that Hulk Hogan at the time, if I'm remembering the scandals at the time, Hulk Hogan publicly denied the racist allegations that Gawker leaked in the video. And feel free to correct me, chat or angry emailers, you know, regardless, obviously I don't support the, you know, infringement into this man's privacy, but I also really, I'm rubbed the wrong way by the idea that, you know, this billionaire came in with an agenda to bankrupt a news organization. Not a very good news organization. I mean, it was Gawker was a gossip rag. It always has been. But underneath the Gawker umbrella is also Gizmodo and Jezebel and Lifehacker and IO9 and Kotaku, which, you know, for better or for worse, they all, I think, are, you know, employing lots of journalists who are, you know, trying to be journalists. And I like that goal. You know, I don't think that anyone is saying, well, I guess some people certainly are saying that what Peter Thiel did should be illegal. I don't disagree with you, Joel, that it's, you know, within the system. I think it's just a bad, sets a really bad template, you know? Yeah, when Gawker goes down, everyone cheers. But what happens if it's Ars Technica? What happens if, you know, some billionaire has a grudge against tech dirt? And
right. I mean, I guess the silver lining to that is this is a trial court decision. We were talking about whether there will be an appeal that results in a published appellate opinion that either confirms what the trial court did or undoes it or otherwise, you know, adjusts it as appellate courts can do. But what stands now is not precedential. It might have that kind of effect for people to say, well, if Hogan could do it,
right.
I can do it too.
I didn't mean legally precedential, but it definitely sets the template regardless.
Right.
You could.
Well, I think there's a, and I also think it's important, and you make up, you bring up a good point, Denise, which is that, you know, Gawker certainly has lost at the trial level before and succeeded on appeal. And I believe its official position on this is that this case will be no different. So, you know, from a legal perspective, I continue to have confidence in, although arguably I shouldn't, at least in my own jurisdiction, that courts of appeals will get this right. Mm-hmm. And certainly at a minimum, even if the verdict stands, they will, you know, the damages will be adjusted. I guess there will be a remittitor to the, $130 million that I think he was awarded.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to Gawker Media. I guess it will be auctioned off.
Well, that was, yeah, and again, I haven't read this, but that's what the bankruptcy petition indicates, is that, you know, they have listed their largest creditors, and Terry Bollea, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan, is their largest creditor. I don't know what their assets are. I mean, presumably they have ad revenue. That would no doubt be their largest asset, but I don't know. I don't know what the next move is.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue to keep an eye on that. It's fascinating development. We have some other things to talk about. Let's move to the trademark arena. I mentioned at the top of the show that Joel is one of the lawyers for the Slants in their case. They have a matter pending, at least the Supreme Court has been asked to get involved in the determination. We've talked a lot about the case on the show. We had Joel's colleague on the show and Ron Coleman. And I just wanted to have Joel bring us up to speed as to timing. Where things stand now is the USPTO has asked the Supreme Court to get involved and undo the appellate court decision. Oh, presumably that's what the USPTO wants the Supreme Court to do, or at least give them guidance, right, about the appellate court decision that Joel and his firm have secured for their client here. What happens next, Joel?
Yeah. What happens next is, you know, the government filed its request to have the Supreme Court take a look at this. Those of you out there that are familiar with the case will recall that back in December, our client, Simon Tam, the Federal Circuit for the Court of Appeals ruled that Section 2A of the Lanham Act, and that is a provision that precludes marks that are deemed to be disparaging from obtaining registrations, trademark registrations, before the patent Patent and Trademark Office, held unconstitutional that section of 2A that addresses disparaging marks. I think, in the interest of completeness, it's worth mentioning that Section 2A also speaks to scandalous and immoral marks. So, you know, things like F-words and dirty pictures have historically been barred registration for the same reason. And the court, the Federal Circuit, specifically put to the side that issue. There is, essentially as an outgrowth of our case, there is a decision currently before the Federal Circuit by the name of In Re Brunetti, in which a clothing company that does business under the name FUCT, again, FUCT, I will allow you to pronounce that yourself, is the lawyer for FUCT claims that, of course, that they are entitled to the registration, and the PTO said no, not so fast. But that determination does not fall within the context of our case. But to answer your question, Denise, yes, we have our reply to the government's petition, that is for the request to, for the Supreme Court to hear our case, is due on the 20th of June. At that point, the government will then it's the briefing on the cert. So at that issue, it's fully briefed. And then over the summer, the court will be in recess, and we would anticipate that late September, early October, the court will issue its determination as to whether or not it will hear our case. Obviously, lurking not too far below the surface is the Redskins case. And in fact, I don't remember now. I think Ron was on the show back in March, but I don't believe at that time the Redskins had filed their petition in a somewhat, I think, unusual procedural maneuver. They have asked the Supreme Court to the extent that it considers our case, to also consider its case simultaneously. They have requested essentially that the Supreme Court divest the Fourth Circuit of its jurisdiction and consider the two cases together. Of course, in our case, we have a client in Simon Tam who was denied registration in the case of the Redskins. That is an issue in which, after at least in the case of one mark, you have 50 years of the organization, the Redskins, using the mark. And, you know, the question they find themselves asking is to what extent can the government, after they've, you know, invested all of that goodwill, come in so many years later and essentially deprive the owner of the mark, you know, their rights attendant to, you know, to all that goodwill that they've built up. So, you know, certainly from a factual perspective, there is some commonality between the two cases. And I suppose as a trademark matter, they are essentially bookends of one another. That is pre-registration and post-registration cancellation. But again, we'll see what the Supreme Court has to say, and if they're ultimately interested in any of these questions.
Right. Thank you for the update, and we're definitely we've already got you on the books for September or whenever in the fall that we know whether cert will be granted, and we'll have you and or Ron come back and talk about the substance of what the Supreme Court might take up here. Interestingly, as we were just discussing a case where one party bankrolled another, I don't know if you guys remember, but we talked a while ago on the show about this foam arrow patent and trademark case that was filed against a pastor who had designed some foam arrows, and a foam arrow company came after him. Turns out in the state of Indiana, even though the defendant was in Seattle. He was sued by a company called Global Archery. And what the reason it caught our attention is actually Lee Chang and Newegg got involved and donated some money toward defense. We're selling T-shirts, anti-patent troll T-shirts to raise money for that. I think the defendant also did some other fundraising to raise money. And actually, they've had a victory in the case. It turns out it's a procedural one, and it doesn't mean that the case won't come back. But it's been, for the time being, thrown out of federal court for lack of jurisdiction over the defendant, which is, I think, just, you know, people always forget in this global age that personal jurisdiction is still something that courts require you to have. It's easier to get jurisdiction over people when they're doing business in various states and other regions via the internet. But the court here found there was not any tie whatsoever between the pastor defendant in this lawsuit and the state of Indiana where he was being sued. So the case has been dropped. Do you remember this case, Emery?
Yeah, vaguely. You know, the issue I think was interesting. I think why I pulled this case up was just because it feels like, you know, one of those perfect confluence of law school exam questions. Like, this is an issue that began with a patent case, and the patent argument was dropped when it showed that there was prior when they saw the prior art that they had had before the patent was filed. Then they moved on to a trademark argument. Now, this is actually, I'd like to put this up to our panel here because I wasn't really aware of this. But the trademark argument was that apparently this LARPing company or, you know, startup, whatever, Gwither, had apparently been using his competitor's trademarks for keyword searches, or as I understand it, had been purchasing keywords from, like, for Google AdWords, but had been purchasing them, like, buying his competitor's trademarks keywords, so that when people searched for their competitor's trademark in Google, advertisements would pop up for his company. But that wasn't the issue that was decided on. It all came back to a personal jurisdiction issue. So I could see this, you know, scrolling on for like three pages of questions for a poor 1L class.
Yes. Exactly. Joel, do you want to just briefly remind us as to the propriety of buying your competitor's trademark as a search term?
Well, I think, you know, and I must, you know, I practice in New York, and I think this issue is largely resolved. But Denise, actually, and I'll answer the question, but correct me if I'm wrong, what is California's take on keyword, you know, advertising in 2016? I mean, the landmark case here no, it wasn't. I'm trying to think of what it was. Was it 1-800-CONTACTS? What was it? I'm trying to remember what it is. I used to know this.
Yep. Nope. Not coming to me. Nope. Especially not in New York. But
I mean,
It's that's, legally that's sketchy, I guess, is what we can give you. I know, you know, people who I think that the law is sufficiently unsettled in the area that you should be cautious about it. I think there have been cases that have come out both ways.
I mean, considering the primary purpose of trademark, as I understand it, is to avoid consumer confusion, it seems like it directly contravenes the entire purpose of trademark law. So I'm surprised that issue didn't get discussed.
I mean, the case that I'm more familiar with, I mean, absolutely, in the Second Circuit, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, you're going to have, even if you don't have your standard federal trademark claim, you are going to be able to fall back on in New York, you know, that state unfair competition claim. It's pretty broad. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of state catch-all. I know, because I've litigated them, I know California has something that's very analogous, at least conceptually, if not in the language itself. So, you know, and you know, the ads themselves, the words in the ads themselves, I mean, I think it's analogous to, you know, that kind of black hat SEO techniques that you know, was kind of fashionable 10 years ago to sort of use your competitor's name in the context of, you know, coding your own web page or whatever so that you get, you know, greater organic inbound traffic. So, It's a problem. Right. Don't do it. Even if you don't fall, you know, within your jurisdiction, within federal trademark infringement, there certainly will be some common law unfair competition or statutory unfair competition claim that you're gonna that no doubt you're gonna run afoul of. So, I think that issue is pretty much resolved at some level, even if it doesn't rise to a formal, you know, federal trademark false advertising claim.
Right. Very very nicely summed up. M&M's, Joel. What's M&M's. Going on in Sweden?
I just was going to say, I'll eat them everywhere but Sweden. I can't even bring them into the country, actually. I think, you know, if I
really
customs, they'll be seized.
Oh.
Yeah, they've actually, my understanding is, and I'm sorry?
Tell us what happened here.
Well, as I understand it, there's some Swedish, well, Mars, which owns M&M's, was not selling M&M's in Sweden until about, I want to say, like 2008, 2009. And the reason for that was that they had many years earlier, and it may have been under Mars' predecessor, engaged in a an agreement with the manufacturer of the I'm just trying to pull up the article here so I can remember the name of the plaintiff here.
Maybe they weren't selling them, or they weren't selling them with the lowercase m. Is this like the no M&Ms or no lowercase m M&Ms?
Well, okay, good point. I admittedly don't know the factual detail. My understanding, though, is that I believe M&Ms are branded everywhere in the world with the lowercase m on them, as opposed to, for example, the English Smartie, which is a similar chocolate confection that does not have a lower M on it. So, right, Marabou, that's what I was looking for. Thanks very much. So my understanding is that they had some 50 years earlier, thereabouts, entered into an agreement with Marabou that they would not sell in Sweden. There was, I guess, and I don't believe the agreement had run its course, but I believe that there was a determination from Mars that its M&M product did not contravene the agreement. And so, as I understand it, they unilaterally started selling again for a period of years. I think there was a protracted back and forth between the Swedish manufacturer and M&M's. And then, you know, the Swedish manufacturer said, listen, you know, you're breaching here, and we're going to hold you accountable. And they sued in Sweden. And, you know, I don't know what the outcome was. Was it an injunction? I believe it's an injunction. So they can't, you know, they can't actually import M&Ms into the country, is my understanding. I don't know anything about Swedish law, but I trust they have something similar that, you know, with a judgment, they forward that along to their customs offices, and no M&Ms will get off the ships.
Wow. Seems really wild. Yes, I don't know. Swedish fish haven't even come into the discussion yet.
They haven't. And it looks like, for what it's worth, they could brand Swedish fish, or the, what are those raspberries they eat over there, with the little M and with the little lowercase M, and they'd be good to go.
That actually brings up a question: could any other company in Sweden now use the little M&M or lowercase M, even I guess lowercase M and M?
I know. I think actually the opposite is true. It seems like that other confection company, was it Mara, the one that was just on the screen, Mara.
But Marabou.
If it was like a non-confectioner related company, I mean, I thought that the issue was that Marabou was concerned that because they were both sort of chocolate companies, and they were concerned about the confusion between their chocolate product and the M&Ms, but it's actually just the letter itself.
Right. Okay. So if you're going to treat the good that narrowly, that and just say that the concern should only relate to chocolate, then there would be something to be said for your position. I can only imagine, though, that Marabou, I'm screwing up the name, Marabou would probably want to extend that as far as they can and to knock out all confections.
Yeah,
but
that makes more
you know,
sense.
the classic trademark example, if some company wants to put a lowercase m on a tractor trailer tire, you know, I'm hard-pressed to believe, and again, I don't know anything about Swedish law, but I'm hard-pressed to believe that would really run afoul of you know, their domestic trademark laws. I would certainly hope not.
Yeah, I don't know. All of this is just reminding me that when my child was younger, a family member went on a trip to Germany and brought back something called a Kinder Egg that for some reason we cannot get in the United States. And I suspect it has something to do with IP children rights. Choking. Yes.
The children choking on small toys.
Oh, that's, yeah, yeah, it, no, you're right. It's the choking.
Yeah, he's not being facetious. That's right.
That's
right.
Yeah, that's right.
The Kinder Egg, nope. The Kinder Surprise. I think there was a ruling that the toy in its little parts was a choking hazard.
I think you're right. Yes. And here I was blaming the entire body of IP law for this. But no, it's an entirely different
body. There's certainly someone you can blame.
Although north of the border in Canada, I believe, you know, if you're ever in Buffalo or for that matter, I guess on your side, Vancouver, I believe they do sell Kinder eggs up there. So,
oh my gosh, Kinder contraband.
Tip of the week.
Yes, exactly. Tip of the week. Let's get to our resources and tips of the week. And of course, preceded by we're going to keep this going as long as you people keep sending me animal selfies. It fits very well in our show today with all the talk about what is copyrightable and what is not. We do have an animal selfie of the week for you. I just love that bumper to death. Thank you, Mike DeCamp, a.k.a. El Jefe 83 on Twitter, for throwing this in my way. There was a scuba diver in Sydney Harbor down there with his GoPro, found a great octopus. And the octopus, of course, snagged his camera. Here we go. We have the video. Look at what a nice octopiggle he found there. That's what we call them in my family for reasons unknown. Yep, there it's got the camera and then wrestled the camera back. The diver had to retrieve his camera, but not before the octopus turned the camera on itself. So that's pretty cool. Our animal selfie of the week. It's not the first time an octopus has been known for its selfie proclivities. Our tip of the week relates to a couple of cautionary tales in the news recently and how to avoid them. Christian Science Monitor in both instances has great pieces on taking good prophylactic steps to keep yourself from getting hacked like Mark Zuckerberg. One of their contributors at the CS Monitor had the same kind of thing happen as happened to Mark Zuckerberg with his account.
Can we just appreciate Mark Zuckerberg's password, by the way? Just everyone that's listening to this, hopefully your password is better than Mark Zuckerberg's password, which he repeated across social networks, which was, drumroll please, da-da-da-1-2-3.
Yes. Let's just have a moment of appreciation for that. And please do read through the article as to all the things that you should do other than just having a password better than da-da-da-1-2-3. Slightly more detailed than that. Good things set out here, primarily related to using a password manager and making sure you're using unique passwords across accounts and that they are secure. So there's that good piece related to that situation. And then, interestingly enough, I think this just happened this last week, Lori Faith Craner, who is the chief technologist at the FTC, found out that it's not difficult for someone to basically usurp your phone number and turn off your cell phone. If they go into a cell phone store, sufficiently convince the staff that they are you and walk out with new phones with your phone number on them. Apparently she was told by the cell phone store in question, and I don't know if she's identified who that is or not, that staff would have asked for ID, and that apparently this person presented a fake ID with Lori's name, but the fraudster's picture, and were given these new phones. So in the This Is What You Can Do section of what Lori herself wrote over as a contributor to Christian Science Monitor, the primary thing she flags is just to make sure that you're using that PIN feature that a lot of cell phone companies have now, where they won't even speak with you. They won't allow you to make any changes to your account whatsoever until you provide them with your security PIN. She wishes they'd do more than that and has a whole section on what carriers should be doing in addition as well. So If you can't take a cautionary tale from Mark Zuckerberg and the chief technologist at the FTC, I don't know who you can. Our resources of the week are twofold. One is from Shapeways. Thank you so much, Michael and Shapeways. Father's Day is rapidly approaching people, and Shapeways blog has a great post on gifts for dad and his dad bod involving things that are 3D printed. Can you expand on this for us, Michael?
I will as I walk out of this room, I will tell the person who wrote that blog post that you liked it, but I don't know.
We need this as our resource of the week in advance of Father's Day. There are all kinds of
is that a suit? I'm in the market for a new suit. That looks good. And that pretty much looks like what I would look like in that suit, I think.
The 3D printed bike mount for, I'm sure they're root beer bottles, a bottle courier for your bike. Seems like an absolutely spectacular dad gift.
That is a good dad gift, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. A chain holder for your Fitbit, a metal 3D printed pizza-shaped bottle opener. Ooh, I really like the Apple Watch band, the 3D printed Apple Watch band. All kinds of great ideas here in this blog post. So thank you, Shapeways. Thank you, Michael's colleague. And also our second resource of the week has to do with Michael himself, who was in a great segment on PBS. What's the name of their series there that you were on, Michael?
It's the PBS Idea Channel. And it's just a great show. They let me sneak in, but it's an amazing show. It's a great place to learn more stuff.
That's awesome. I'm so glad you said they sat down with you for something along the lines of what we do here on our show a really, really long time. But then they managed to distill it down into 10 digestible minutes, which we never even attempt.
It's amazing when they cut everything down, how it all sounds very coherent.
That's fantastic. And Emery, did you have any thoughts on this?
No, not at all. Idea Channel was great. Go check it out if you've got some time.
Cool. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. It's been a really, really fun show. Loved all our topics, loved all our guests. Michael Weinberg from Shapeways. Anything else that we haven't discussed today that you want to let people know about before we sign off?
No, we've done the white paper. We did the open source hardware certification. So, I don't know, go outside and enjoy the weekend, everybody.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Some pictures and we'll figure out if they're subject to copyright or not.
There you go.
Joel McMull from Archer and Grenier, best of luck with everything that you're working on. Is there anything else you want to highlight for our audience before we say goodbye?
No, I don't think so. The next few months will tell a lot, so we'll definitely keep you and your listeners in tune to what's going on.
Excellent. Yes. And we'll be back in touch with you and Ron as the Slants case continues to progress. Thank you so much for joining us. Emery, great to see you. How's your summer going?
It's going great. I'm still trying to figure out housing, but I'm looking forward to the show every week.
Yes. I know we have Bay Area listeners and friends. So Emery's going to be up there in the fall. Has a wife and a cat on board. And would love San Francisco friendly accommodations. So let us know. You can let him know. You can email him.
Yeah, actually, feel free to reach out to me at my. You can follow me on Twitter, Emery Roan at Twitter, earoan.info, emeryr.info for my website, or Emery at twit.tv. Please.
Yes. And I should mention the reason that Emery's going to be in San Francisco is he's doing an internship at EFF. How wonderful is that?
Congratulations.
Perfect. I'm so proud.
Congratulations. Thanks. Very excited. It's the reason why I'm here, actually. So, yeah.
Yes. Very excited for you. You can email me, too. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Find me and Emery and our co-host Mike Keyes on Twitter as well. You can also interact with us between the shows other than by email if you want to jump in. As I said, we see things on Twitter all the time. It's very helpful for you to ping us there or over on our Facebook page for the show or the Google Plus page or community too. All great places to let us know what you're thinking, how you like the show, any guests that you think we should be considering inviting on the show. We'd love to hear from you with any and all of that. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll take the time to head on over to our archive of shows if you're curious about the cases that we've talked about in the past and how they're developing over time. The great guests that we have on week in and week out. The archive is at twit.tv/twill. And if you like joining us live, we record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So you can jump onto twit.tv at that time each week and find us. We will be back next week with another episode of This Week in Law. Until then, take care.